It's great to be here at Wellington Regional Hospital today for this pre-budget announcement with Health Minister Tony Ryle. Shortly we'll be heading over to visit the Blood and Cancer Centre. The team in that unit are doing an outstanding job. They're regularly achieving the national health targets for faster cancer radiation treatment and are providing the care faster. Each year they treat around about 6,400 patients from across the region and provide around about 26,000 radiation and chemotherapy treatments. Today's pre-budget announcement will help them to improve the services even more. Before we get started, just to clarify, we'll run through the details of our pre-budget announcement first and take any questions on that. After that, I'll take a few questions on any other topics that you might have. Then we're heading over for a photo opportunity of our visit to the Blood and Cancer Centre in the main hospital block. So today I'd like to reiterate health is one of the top priorities for this government. In each of our previous three budgets, it's been the biggest recipient of new spending, and it'll be the same in Budget 2012. Even though we will be delivering that with effectively a zero budget on 24th of May, health will get a big funding boost. We will be making some savings from within the health vote, but for the most part, this boost in funding will come from savings and revenue initiatives from across other government departments. The new funding will allow us to do a whole range of new initiatives in the health area. As you know, last week we announced a new initiative around rheumatic fever, a new school throat swabbing program. That's part of a $24 million five-year campaign to reduce rheumatic fever and will target 35,000 at-risk children in seven regions across New Zealand. Today I can confirm funding for four new health initiatives in Budget 2012. These are at least 4,000 more elective procedures a year, shorter waiting times for important diagnostic tests, better and faster cancer services, and a new national register for patients treated for heart conditions to improve the quality of care across hospitals. Funding for these new initiatives comes to $101 million over 4 years. The Minister will talk to you a bit more about that in a minute. As I said earlier, we also need to make some savings in health so that we can increase our investment into the health sector. From next year, the prescription charges will increase from $3 to $5 for the first 20 prescription items per year. After that, they'll remain free. At the moment, when you get most of your prescriptions filled at a pharmacy, you pay $3. The government pays the rest of the cost of the medicine, which can be quite substantial. From next year, we will be increasing the charge to $5, which will be a maximum increase of $40 per year for a person or family. Although, of course, in many cases, the increase will be less than that. Under sixes will continue to get their prescriptions free. It's important to note that this is an increase that allows us to spend more on frontline health services than we would otherwise have been able to do. So it's a conscious decision from the government to increase that part charge so that that money can be applied to more medical services, more medicines, and a greater level of health care for New Zealanders. The policy raises $40 million a year when fully implemented, or $140 million over the first 4 years. It's important to note this payment applies only to the first 20 prescriptions an item or a family gets a year. After that, it's free. Currently, around a third of all prescription items are free, and that won't change. And this will increase, and with this increase, no person or family need to pay more than that extra $40 a year. Although, as I said, in many cases, that increase will be less. This is the first increase in any prescription charges in 20 years, and New Zealand will continue to have low prescription charges compared to almost every other developed country. In Australia, for example, the standard prescription charge is up to New Zealand $45 or $7.45 for low-income earners. And in England, it's around about $16 per prescription. I'm now going to hand over to the Minister to explain these budget initiatives in more details. We'll take any questions you have on health, and then I'll take any other questions you have, recognising that I can't have a tremendously long time today because I don't want to hold people up who are going over to see.
Well, thank you very much, Prime Minister. And can I start by thanking the Prime Minister and the Cabinet for their strong support of Vote Health over the last three, 4 years. As you've commented, health has always been the biggest single spending item in every budget, and it's continuing to be so. So this year we're continuing our investment to improve the amount of elective surgery for New Zealanders. This is vitally needed surgery for people that helps relieve discomfort and lets them get back on track with their lives. We've increased that number by about 27,000 extra operations over the last 3.5 years. We want to bump that up further with another 4,000 extra procedures over the next budget year. We're also putting in place a new IT system to support us in our drive to get shorter waiting time for CT scans, MRIs and colonoscopies. Right now we can't give you reliable waiting times across the country, and if we are to reduce those waiting times we need to get a much stronger understanding of what those are. We've made a pretty big investment in cancer over the last 3 years, including getting to the situation where no New Zealander has been sent to Australia for radiation treatment since the end of 2008. And in this budget we want to take our investment in cancer further with $33 million for better and faster services for cancer patients. And this includes a very significant investment in dedicated nurses who will support individual patients throughout the course of their cancer treatment from referral to discharge. Research has shown that cancer patients during their treatment can be dealt with by 28 different doctors and many more different nurses. So building on an experience that we've had in Christchurch, and one of the nurses is with us here today, we're going to be establishing these dedicated cancer nurse positions who will be the one point of call, the first point of contact, the case managers, the case coordinators for cancer patients. And what that research and experience in Christchurch has shown is much better support for families and those with cancer, and also much better outcomes for the patients, which is very positive as well. If I just repeat what the Prime Minister said, we are funding some of our health initiatives this year from an increase in the prescription charge from $3 to $5 from the 1st of January. It's very clear, it's very important to be aware that that applies to the first 20 items. And once people have got 20 items, they can then go to their pharmacist, get a card which entitles them to have the rest of their items free. And this is for a family, a maximum they need pay of 20 particular items, and if they don't use the same pharmacy, they can certainly just collect their receipts, and that will assist them to get that card. So as the Prime Minister said, no family need pay more than $40 a year in additional prescription charges. Many won't even pay that. This compares pretty favourably overseas. Australia, low-income people, superannuitants pay New Zealand equivalent of $5.80, $40 if they're a working person, and of course it's around about $16 New Zealand in Britain. Spain announced last week, I think it was, that for the first time ever, superannuitants will pay prescription charges in Spain. They're going to pay 10% of their medicine's cost, which just indicates that the world situation is really very tight in many places. And we're certainly reflecting that with our decision that we want to put up those prescription charges slightly and dedicate that money to additional services in the health budget. Prime Minister.
Questions?
Regarding prescription charges, what allowances will we make for low-income families and beneficiaries? It will be more of a significant and possibly even benefit for those in high income.
The charge is going from $3 to $5 for everybody. Currently there's a 20-item cap, so beneficiary families, any family, face the maximum of $60 in any year. That's now going to go to a maximum of $100 in any year. Anybody who's got difficulty making ends meet, such as any other increase in the cost of living, are able to go to WINS to get any support. This is the first increase in prescription charges in 20 years. And well, the health budget this year is made up of savings not only made within the health budget, but also savings made by all the other 19 ministers in the government. And when the budget documents are released, you'll see that health is the biggest ticket item and savings have been contributed across the board. This increase in the prescription charges, that money is being reinvested into the health services that you're going to see not only today, but also in the run-up to the budget.
The overall spending in health over 4 years, though, is considerably more than $140 million. It's in the order of probably about $1 billion.
How many dedicated cancer news coordinators does
it have now? I haven't got the exact number of how many we've got now, but I think you'll find that we'll be able to grow that by about another 40 to 50 over the next year or so. Yeah, well, we've only just got that decision, and as you know, it's a pretty lengthy decision. But look, this is a pretty complex and quite serious area. What the courts are finding is that we as a system cannot use family status as a way to necessarily target payments to people. So it's quite complex. I think we all take our hats off to the people who care for disabled children. It's not an easy job. And we do have support and systems for those people. But the outcome of this decision we're still having to digest. But it could have very significant ramifications for other parts of not only the health service but the rest of the government. So for example, right now if your mother is aged and she's getting home support or personal care, we can't pay you to provide that. We have to get somebody else to provide that for them. Under this decision, it's a very clear message that we could not have that exclusion, that in fact we could pay family members to provide care for their elderly family members. So you can see that the costs certainly start to increase, and this is one of the big considerations that we've got in mind.
The court has found that they are unreasonably they've rejected the ministry's rejection of that they were being
That's right.
So they're saying, in a way, they should be paid if they're doing their job, or if they're not what you're taking from the judgment?
No, that's what the judgment says. The judgment indicates that these people should be paid. So what we have to do is work through what the full financial implications of that are. When you consider that we're borrowing a lot of money from overseas, it does mean that we have to face quite a significant financial constraint, and there will be a financial impact from this. It's difficult to actually give you an exact answer on what the cost is because it depends on how many people who are caring for disabled family members want to be paid, how many disabled people in residential care want to move back to their family members, and what level of support that will be. So we're going to have to digest the decision over the next few weeks to see what our options are.
Do you agree that it's about $500 million?
Potentially it could be as high as $500 million. It depends on how many people want to change their current situation. So for example, if half the people who are disabled people who are getting some sort of care want to get that paid for by a family member, and we get a lot of people, say half the people in residential care, move back to their families, you're looking at the vicinity of $450 million a year extra. So it can be a very big ticket item. It would depend on what parameters we put around it. But we understand the fact that these people make such a sacrifice to support their children, but at the same time we've got to balance the interests not only of the people being cared for and the carers, but also the taxpayers.
Do you think on the surface it's a bad look for the ministry to be seemingly going into these parents who are struggling?
Well, look, it doesn't make you look the most caring person at times when you have to take a position like this, but the fact is we all respect the work that those family members are doing, but there are quite significant implications potentially from this decision. And I've just explained to you that we could find ourselves having to pay family members who are caring for their aged family members in the future. Now that is a very big ticket item, and that's the reason why the ministry and the government have been taking the position we have, because we simply can't be faced with a bill of that magnitude.
But the court notes that ACC allows family members to look after injured family members. So is that not a precedent for really operating within the government?
Well, that's a much smaller number of people. And what we have to consider in this decision is not only those who are currently being cared for by family members, but those who are being cared for by family members who aren't getting any support from the government, and those who are in residential care who may go back to their families to be supported. So you can see how the costs can begin to escalate. The government does provide these families with support, quite significant amounts of support, about a quarter of $1 billion a year, to provide them with respite and time out. If we were to give that money to the families, then actually we would also then need to look at money to provide respite and time out. So you can see that the costs begin to escalate.
Just to clarify, is that $250 million just for support for the families of disabled?
That's the support that we're currently providing under disability support services in the home.
Just a quick comment, aren't prescriptions a frontline health service? Doesn't this constitute a cut to frontline health services?
No, this is not a cut to frontline health services. We've put $180 million extra into medicines over the last three budgets. And that the money that's going to be raised from this increase in prescription charges will be going in to support more frontline services. And some of those we've announced today, better cancer treatment, more elective surgery.
And across, look, across the government in the last 3.5 years, we've lifted costs and levies in a number of different areas as the charges have better reflected the actual costs involved. So from time to time, the government will always lift those. I mean, frontline services, it could arguably be what is the output and productivity from the health system. Now, we know in the last 3.5 years we've delivered much greater results out of the health system, and having more money spent in health will, in our view, deliver better results. But as I said earlier, we made a conscious decision. We could have chosen to leave prescription charges at $3 and had less money to spend on health, or said to New Zealanders, look, we think you paying a small increase more will give you much better peace of mind when it comes to cancer treatment, elective surgery, and those other important issues. So in the end, it's a trade-off, but we think it's a trade-off in the right direction for the vast bulk of New Zealanders.
But doesn't a cut to primary care, you end up paying a lot more down the road because someone doesn't get a prescription that nips something in the bud quickly?
Well, that makes the that's making a case that because the prescription charge goes from $3 to $5, people won't either pick up their prescription or go to the doctor. I don't think there's a huge amount of evidence to support that. There might be some people that don't go, but people in that difficult financial position, they should go to WINS and we'll give them more support. And for a third of all prescriptions, they're free anyway. We already see today some prescriptions not being picked up when they're free. So I think there's some correlation, but not a huge one. Well, it's not the government's intention. If you go and have a look at this move from $3 to $5, it effectively reflects inflation increases. Since in the 20 years that there hasn't been an increase, but you know, we are in financially constrained times. I think it's as I said, a genuine trade-off. We could have chosen not to do that, but we actually actively elected to do it.
Minister, can you just clarify how much of that $1 million?
Well, all this new from within health, look, you'd have to wait to see the budget because we can't pick out specific numbers for that. But it's quite clear that when you see the health budget, it's made up of a combination of savings within health and savings within other government departments. And that's what you have when you have a zero budget. To have some money here, it's got to come from there.
Can you give us any indication of how much?
No, you'll have to wait for the budget.
Okay, yeah, so what do we, if we're happy with health, can we move, we'll move into everything else in about 10 minutes and we'll go. You mean in terms of other things across the whole of government? Oh, you'll have to wait and see the overall budget. I mean, what the budget will show is that there is actually a substantial amount of spending, billions and billions of dollars of expenditure over the next 4 years in critical areas like health and education, science and innovation, other areas, and that's matched by either an increase in charging or a reduction in expenditure, which matches those two out. So even though it's a zero budget, it doesn't mean there's a zero increase in expenditure. It means there's an increase in some areas and reductions in others. But you'll need to see the full package come May 24th.
So we're going to see other levies, other sort of user charges in the budget?
There's not a huge number, but you know, there are some minor changes around, as I said, I think last week, around tax base broadening and the likes.
What about ECA?
Well, there are some changes there, but they're structured differently from this, and they're largely about trying to increase the participation rate for young children that aren't getting currently ECE, particularly Māori and Pacific kids. There's not a direct cost increase, but there are some potential flow-on increases. Yeah. Sorry, Karen.
You said you will support the members' plan to...
First reading, yeah.
First reading.
Assuming there is a members bill and assuming it's drawn out of the ballot, yep.
What are the particular aspects of this issue that you want to see teased out of that
Oh, look, I think let's just have that debate. As I've said, personally, I'm not opposed to gay marriage, but you know, it's an issue that the government wouldn't put on the agenda today because we don't think it's a top priority issue. But if a member wants to put a bill in, then we can't and obviously wouldn't stop that process, and I'm more than happy for that debate to be aired through a select committee process.
But doesn't that say something if you're not prepared to front foot that yourself? You obviously don't feel terribly strongly about it.
Well, it's not my number one issue, that's absolutely for sure. That's been true of, I think, most of those sort of conscience moral issues, if you like. The previous government had a lot of those on the agenda, from prostitution law reform through to civil union. We actually haven't had any, or very few, I don't think we've had any. And that's really reflected that these are difficult economic times, they're big challenges for the government, and we need to use our precious time in Parliament really to resolve those issues. We accept this is an issue for a small group of New Zealanders. As I say, if it comes up through the members' process, then we'll back that. But in terms of government House time, we have bigger priorities.
So just saying that you would support it to first reading, isn't that a little bit of a cop-out, though? Because basically you're saying, I'll support it until we've had the debate and see what people think about it.
Oh, not really. I mean, what it says is exactly what I've said. You know, I'm more than happy for it to be that debate to be held. I'm more than happy to have that discussion. I also voted for euthanasia to go through to select committee. There's no guarantee actually it would get through to a select committee. That would depend on the makeup of the rest of Parliament. But I, for one, am personally not opposed to having that debate.
Just to clarify, what would your vote be in a third reading should
a bill? Don't know.
Just around labour laws,
yeah.
Why are you changing?
Yeah, so in terms of the labour laws, I mean, the Labour Minister's making an announcement today. There are a few changes, but if you haven't caught up with them, broadly, they are exactly the policy that we campaigned on, which is removing the requirement to conclude collective bargaining, allowing employers to opt out of multi-employer bargaining, allowing for partial pay reductions in the case of partial strikes, and removing the 30-day rule that forces non-union members to take union terms and conditions. So they are all of our policies. The one thing we didn't campaign on, although it wasn't something we said we wouldn't do either, is really just around the period of time in which either unions or employers can initiate a collective bargaining. The moment it's 40 days for an employer and 20 days for a union, we don't think it makes sense to have a differential date, and so we'll have the same amount of time for both.
What's the intention of that?
Oh, you mean in terms of the same amount of time? Or oh, I think it just doesn't really make any sense for one side to have sort of a head start, if you like. It just seems to make sense that both parties are on the same foot.
So at the moment, the union can start their process
earlier, 20 days earlier.
Just on the economy,
yeah.
I think Labour's put out a statement today talking about the possibility of a double-dip recession. If some of the figures out today are obviously a bit,
Especially in terms of the domestic economy, there's nothing I've seen that would indicate from either the Reserve Bank or Treasury that we will be going into a recession. Growth numbers have been, while modest in the last few years, we've grown in 10 of the last 11 quarters, and the budget documents will show that we're likely to experience what I describe as reasonably robust levels of growth in 2013-14. The risk is always the impact that Europe and the slowdown in Europe has on the rest of the world, and our big risks are Australia, where unemployment's picked to go up. The Reserve Banks have one rate cut in Australia, may well have two others, and where their economy is definitely slowing. And despite all the things that are said about Australia, it's very much a two-speed economy. You've got substantial growth taking place in the mining sector, and virtually every other part of the economy is weak. House market's off about 10% in Australia. You've got a situation where the tourism sector is very weak because of the exchange rate. Manufacturing data is weak. So one of the problems for us, of course, is that while we are in an Australasian labour market, so we compete in that regard, they are our biggest market. So if Australia slows down or China slows down, it has some impact. So if the global conditions are very weak, that can have some impact. We can't rule that out. But at the moment, the data we see looks still reasonably robust.
What do you make of Russell Norman's figures today, claiming that the tax cuts have effectively cost $2 billion when you look at them on the GST revenue? Again, coming back to that.
promise that they would be revenue neutral.
Yeah, absolute nonsense, and he's been totally disingenuous with the truth. I mean, if Russell Norman wants to go and pick two bits of the tax package out and subtract the two and come up with a differential, that's fine, but go and tell that to everybody else who's paying a lot more taxes in the overall package. The reality is that the changes we made to depreciation laws and the like had a disproportionately larger impact on higher income earners. And in fact, if you look at the overall tax package, the Treasury's estimates are that they're fiscally positive. So Russell Norman can't play fast and loose with the truth. If he wants to add up the entire tax package, then he'll find it's actually the tax cuts overall were revenue neutral to positive.
So you're satisfied that I think over the 4-year period,
totally.
You said that you're still going to come out.
And that's Treasury's view as well.
Yeah. What's your response to the criticism that Hyperica gave to you directly after last Thursday's announcement?
Well, I believe we've done everything we committed to do, which the first thing we'd say is, I mean, huge sympathy for those families. There's a lot of grief, and I completely understand that for some of those families, they will only get closure if they can get their loved ones out of the mine. We've always said we'll do whatever we can as long as it's feasible and credible to do so, and that position absolutely remains, which is we started by saying a condition of sale of the mine would be that under, as long as it was credible to get in there, that their buyer had to undertake a body recovery program. Number of buyers either walked away because the environment is so difficult, or they walked away because of that condition. Solid Energy themselves were nervous of that condition, and I personally told them, or at least my office did, that it would be not possible for the government to sign off on the sale of the mine unless they could meet that condition. I've also said to the families when I last went to see them that in my view, for different reasons, the interests of a new buyer were directly aligned to those of the families, which is a new buyer obviously wants to get in the mine to extract the resource. And in doing so, if they can get in to extract the resource, there's a very high chance, I think, that they can get in to remove any bodies that may remain. So we remain totally committed to that process. The government has put in significant resources so far. We've made it clear to Solid Energy as the buyer of the mine that the government stands ready to put more resources in if a credible program comes up. And there has never been a credible or feasible plan shown. The report to the families by Bruce McLean, their engineer, itself says, or at least the draft report that was seen, and may have changed in the final, but I'd be very surprised if it did, itself says, Bruce McLean's report to the family says, that it may never be possible to get in the mine. So it's a very difficult, hostile environment. So I absolutely want to get in that mine if we can, but it's a very difficult environment.
With all the advice that you've had, how realistic is it that they'll actually be able to get these bodies back?
Well, I'm a politician, not an engineer, and I can't assess that. I've had a number of experts who've said to me it's very difficult to get in there, and a number of people who've said, look, it might be possible. Solid Energy's assessments put it at 5-10% of getting in there, but they will want to get into the mine. There's a substantial resource in there, and they are totally committed because of the legal obligations on them to undertaking body recovery as long as we don't put at risk the lives who may go in, or those who may go in for that body recovery program.
Is that still fair to call it body recovery, or realistically looking for remains?
There'll be a combination. I mean, the advice I've had is that there's been a very substantial fire in the mine. And so if you're asking me, is it likely that there would be 29 bodies in the mine, the answer to that is extremely unlikely on the advice I've had.
Was the NDC ever made aware that a body recovery could be financially feasible? That seems to be the sticking point for them. That one
Well, look, the real issue here is it credible to actually get in there? Now, I mean, taken to the extreme, you could take the entire top of Paparoa Ranges off, but I think no one is arguing that would be credible, and probably wouldn't have the support of other political parties. But as long as it's feasible and credible to do so and safe, then the government will back that program. Sorry? I'm more than happy to see the families again, and I've seen them on numerous occasions. I've spoken to Don Elder myself. My understanding of his report of the meeting is that the vast overwhelming bulk of the families understood absolutely the position. I mean, look, this is a really, really awful and difficult position for those families, and I have huge sympathy. If you put those 29 families to one side, I would strongly argue I'm at the top of the list of the rest of New Zealanders who want to get into that mine. But we can't do it and put at risk the lives of others that might go in there, and it has to be safe and credible. If we can do that, then we'll go on to the mine.
Sorry, we're going to have to wrap this up very shortly.
The condition of the sale, because Carol Rose says that's where they were being portrayed. That's never conditioned.
Well, it's always been feasible and credible. Credibility, I mean, to the extreme, credibility is you could take the entire top of Paper Isles off.
So you're saying that financial feasibility is implicit in that?
It's implicit in credibility, yeah.
Can I just ask you a quick question? Is New Zealand trialling or looking at all at surveillance drones, unmanned surveillance?
Look, I don't have any advice, and I can't answer that question. I don't have any knowledge on that, but I can get you some advice.
Just a quick one on the financial services company. Yep. There's been reports that Treasury are pretty enthusiastic about some aspects of the idea. Like financial incentives. Is it still a live idea?
Absolutely. So, look, it's gone back and forth with the officials over the last few years. In budget 2011, we made the appropriate tax changes which would allow the International Financial Hub to operate. Where the sticking point is, or the disagreement, if you like, is that one of the major issues that occurred in terms of the hub, one of the major points that was used overseas was to financially pay people to come and pay for their accommodation, have an international financial centre as they did in Ireland. That has been rejected by Treasury, and we've accepted that view. But the technical nature of allowing it to occur has gone through the budget, and my understanding is that there is you're starting to see people undertaking more activity in that area.
Can I ask one more question about the legal
agreement? Yeah, sure.
Employers will only have to negotiate in good faith in terms of collective bargaining. There's no legal binding in that to protect employees.
Well, implicitly they've got to negotiate in good faith, and they'll do that. But the law currently says they have to conclude a collective bargain, and that's what's been taken off the table, because what's happening at the moment is there are agreements that are going on forever and they've never been concluded.
But doesn't that leave open for long-standing action such as the out of jobs and no resolution coming about?
I think it's more likely to lead to a resolution, actually. Okay, thanks very much.